Coming up next, another episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show with my two guests. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. We get a good one today with two guests. Later on, I'm bringing on Akam Nagra, who you probably better know as Ball Don't Stop on social media. We talk about a whole bunch of different topics, the trades that happened over the weekend, and a bunch else. But first, bringing on Andrew Schleck, who is the host of Down to Dunk, Oklahoma City Thunder podcast. He also is a podcaster over at The Athletic. Andrew and I broke down the NBA Cup, previewed that, especially through the OKC Thunder lens. So that's coming up next after Father John Misty. Preview the Thunder and Bucks in the NBA Cup Championship, bringing on Andrew Schleck from The Athletic and the Down to Dunk podcast. All right, Andrew, so the Thunder are 20-5, best record in the Western Conference, third best record in the NBA, number one defensive rating, number eight offensive rating. They haven't faced Giannis much in recent years at all. Only faced him once in the last three seasons. That was last March. Giannis had 30 points on 13 of 18, 19 rebounds. Bucks won that game, 118-93. So we don't have a lot of examples of what OKC may or may not do against this Bucks team. But I'm curious for your initial thoughts here with, you have Giannis who might be the MVP, could be right going against SGA. What are your expectations for how the Thunder, with their league best defense, are going to try to defend and slow down Giannis Antetokounmpo?
Yeah, I think that it's certainly going to be by committee. It's not going to be just one guy. The Thunder don't have really one guy, because I think you'd like to have somebody that's bigger to defend Giannis, a guy that's like 6'8", 6'9", long arms, all of that. They don't really have that guy on the roster, but they do have Lu Dort, who I think is going to probably get the primary assignment to begin with. Alex Caruso, if you watch the Bulls play the Bucks last year at all, Caruso got that assignment a lot and did quite well against Giannis. And so I think that they have multiple guys that they can throw on him. And if you think about the way that the Thunder defend in general, they pack the paint. Like they sell out to keep teams from getting into the paint. And that's kind of the perfect way to defend Giannis in general, is like you just need to keep him from getting paint touches. And that's the way that the Thunder like to defend. They give up the most corner threes in the league. They've done that for a while. And it's because of this defensive scheme that they have, where they like to pack the paint and recover. Obviously, the three-point shot is super valuable, and I think teams have figured that out. But I think that the Thunder and Mark Degnault will tell you that something that's way more valuable is getting shots at the rim. And so they want to take that away as much as they can. And it starts with the perimeter defense, which the Thunder have three of the best perimeter defenders in the NBA, and Dort, Cason Wallace, and Alex Caruso. Also mentioned Jalen Williams. J-Dub has been an amazing defender so far this season. But then I just think that it's going to be by committee. You have Hartenstein that's going to be at the rim, and he's been fantastic for OKC on the defensive end. But it's going to be multiple guys. Even Kendrick Williams off the bench, I think, is going to get a crack at Giannis. So they're not short of guys that I think could do okay on Giannis, but it really will be by committee and then this through their scheming on the defensive end.
I think you're right. And that's what does make things interesting for a guy like Andre Jackson in this game, is Doc Rivers going to pull him quickly. We saw the Hawks on Saturday in the semifinals. They're helping off Andre Jackson in that game. Yeah. Again, trying to protect the paint. It's obviously easier said than done to keep Giannis away from the basket. He's also added the mid-range, career high for mid-range this year. He had the beautiful fadeaway on a switch against Dyson Daniels late in that game as well. So Giannis is developing some counters, but obviously you're more than happy if Giannis is forced to take a 45%, 40% mid-range jumper rather than 70%+ at the rim. And so that's where I think OKC, you're spot on. Maybe it's Caruso sometimes. Maybe it's Kendrick Williams other times. Maybe it's even a Jalen Williams on a switch defending Giannis on ball. But it's about Isaiah Hartenstein helping a bit off of Brook Lopez in the corner. It's about whoever that weak side help defender is against Andre Jackson collapsing together to slow down Giannis Antetokounmpo. With that said, though, Andrew, the Bucks have changed their team midway through. They had a horrific start this year. They got off to a horrible start. We see AJ Green replacing Pat Connaughton in the rotation, Andre Jackson playing more minutes. Taurean Prince is shooting the hell out of the ball this season after he replaced Jay Crowder in free agency. The Bucks are a better team right now than they were at the start of the year, and they're a different team than they were last year when Malik Beasley was starting. Now they have Gary Trent as well, Chris Middleton coming off the bench. They're a different team, but so is OKC. You mentioned Caruso, Hartenstein as well. This is a completely different team. Now, I think with Oklahoma City, we've seen them this year show the ability to play a bunch of different styles. They started the year with Chet Holmgren. They were absolutely unbelievable. He goes out injured. Then they have to play with small ball for six or so games before Hartenstein came back. And then Isaiah Hartenstein comes back, and he has changed the way this team has looked offensively with his playmaking. What have you seen from Isaiah Hartenstein with how he's added a new layer to this Thunder offense?
Yeah, I remember the first game that he played, and we saw Shea and J-Dub come off of screens from Hartenstein, and it was almost like jarring for them because there hasn't been a screener like this in Oklahoma City since Steven Adams. Like they just don't have guys. They do a lot of guard to guard screening, which does it allows you to get switches, but it doesn't always allow you to get a ton of space. And so the fact that you have this screener that comes in and he sets these just monster screens, and these guys can pull up from the mid range. They have a lane to the basket. They can take the pull up three. You know, they just have options. And I think that's really what he's given them, is he's given them options, not only off of screens, but they love to throw the ball to him in the middle of the court and kind of allow him to operate. This team has a lot of guys that can really cut off ball, and so he's great at finding those guys. And then the lob threat, which is something the Thunder really could never figure out last year. You know, even to Chet, like it was very rare, and it was a kind of an ongoing joke that this might be one of the worst lob throwing teams in the NBA last year. And somehow they've kind of figured it out this year with Hartenstein. And some of that is with J-Dub. There's like this connection that I think everybody that is around the Thunder thought, okay, those two, there's something with just the basketball IQ between those two that I think they're going to figure something out. And we started to see that a little bit. There's been a connection between those two that I think will continue to grow. And the fact that they have the lob threat, which I don't know which will help all that much tomorrow, just because the Bucks do such a good job of preventing just lobs and easy shots at the rim. But that lob connection has been something that the Thunder have started to really tap into that they haven't really had. And so just having a big guy that, obviously, I think the rebounding is probably the first thing people think of when they think about adding this guy, because the Thunder were such a poor defensive rebounding team. But he adds that dimension. He adds just size. And he's a smart player. Sam Presti said before the season that, and it was really funny because he said, you know, we would have signed him if he was 6'8". And then like a couple minutes later, he like brought it up again. He was like, I think we would have signed him if he was 6'5", you know? And like, I was just like, how short does this guy have to be for you to still want him on your team? But they love his basketball, like just the way he plays. He just plays the right way. He's unselfish. He is a great defender. He gives them this dimension where the Thunder, I think, had a really good fastball last year. And it was that team with Chet spreading the court five out. And it was really good. But they didn't really have something else to throw at teams. Like once teams figured that out in some capacity, they were not as difficult to defend. Now that you can throw Hartenstein out there and you have this five out, and the Thunder did this against when they played in that cup game the other night, when the opposing team would go big, they would go small. And they do this a lot. Like anytime an opposing team goes big, like especially off the bench, the Thunder aren't like, okay, we need a big guy to match up with them. You know, the Rockets threw Steven Adams out there, and you think like, okay, well, the Thunder needs somebody big. No, every time Steven Adams touched the court, you know who touched the court? It was Kenrich Williams. They love to like invert that. They want teams to adjust to them. And it's just been interesting to see that, because now they have all these different ways they can play, and their hand has been forced, like you mentioned, like they've had these like three iterations that have happened throughout the season so far, and they've been forced into that, but they figured out how to do it, how to play in all these different ways. And I think like once Chet comes back, once they get toward the playoffs, they're going to be able to kind of hopefully fine tune that heading into the playoffs. And then you can play with anybody.
I think you mentioned it, the how they're dictating the way they want to play. They're not reacting to what the other team is doing. They're saying, no. You're going to adjust to us.
Yeah.
And that's what 100%. Mark Daigneault, OKC's head coach, can now do now with all their options. And to me, that's what makes it most exciting when Chet eventually returns later in the season, because then you could go with the two bigs and maintain spacing, maintain skill. Chet can be that third scorer on the floor. He can be a spot-up shooter. He can be a versatile defender as well. So you add that later in the season when already – so far this season, they've played 635 minutes without Hartenstein or without Holmgren. They have a plus 8.5 net rating, according to PBV stats. And lineups with just Hartenstein, no Chet, which is, you know, they have not shared the floor at all this year. They are plus 13.8 on the floor. Their defense has improved. Chet Holmgren without Isaiah Hartenstein, 265 minutes. They're a plus 16.1. So all three iterations have been absolutely dominant. And so later in the year, you add Chet, it's just going to be a fourth one that Daigneault can pull out come playoff time. And that's where I think against the Milwaukee Bucks in this playoff-like style setting, it's single elimination. It's different than a full seven-game series where you make adjustments and all that. But these teams have days to prepare for their opponent. You damn well know both these sides, like they did for each of the matchups. On Saturday, they're all prepped. Tonight, on Tuesday, they're going to be all prepped. So I think you're going to see a good example of how OKC and Milwaukee too, but for OKC especially, with all their versatility, might change things up mid-game. They might. Like, if you just see the Bucks out there, if they go with Giannis at the five, that doesn't necessarily mean the Thunder will have to go big. Maybe they try to go a bit small and change things up.
Yeah, Mark likes to play with lineups. Like, that's for sure something that, you know, if you've covered a Mark Daigneault team for any period of time, is like they like to be different. They like to throw out different lineups. You know, the starting lineup is not always going to be out there after halftime. You know, they like to change that up at half. And so we know that he's going to change things up. I mean, their rookie AJ Mitchell has played a significant role for them off the bench all season.
He's good, man.
He's a really good player.
For people who don't know anything about AJ Mitchell, can you describe what his game is like? Because a ton of fans are like, who?
Yeah. AJ, the thing that sticks out about AJ, and this stuck out from the moment that I met him, is like, he is just so smart. He's a 6'5 guard that can handle the ball. He can play off ball a little bit. I worried a little bit how he would hold up defensively, but he's done really well. He just competes, and he can do a little bit of everything. The thing that the Thunder, if you're talking about, like, what do the Thunder need? Well, they probably need a little bit more juice off the bench with, like, a guy that can get his own shot. And AJ Mitchell has answered that call a few times this season. He's just an NBA player. Like, he can handle the ball in a pick and roll. He can get to the hoop. He can shoot the three. It's been kind of big for the Thunder this season to have him. You know, they drafted Nikola Topic in the lottery last year, and he's been hurt and, you know, is not going to play this whole season. And to have a guy in this guard position that can come in and play right away has been interesting. And the Thunder, the way that they do film is that they break off into different groups, and the group that AJ Mitchell's a part of is like in this quote unquote creator group that is with Shea and J-Dub. And it's those three that will break off and go watch film together. And, you know, AJ is like one of the creators on the team. And so for him to do it in his rookie season on this really good team, he's on a two-way contract, which you'd expect those guys to play with the G League a lot. He hadn't been called down to the G League once so far this season, which I think is really interesting and indicative of how he's played so far.
It's interesting to me that you said how if the Thunder need one thing, it's probably that juice off the bench, and how AJ Mitchell has helped answer that call with his abilities as a rookie. He's an upperclassman. He was a junior at UC Santa Barbara last year, and he improved as a shooter. He got better in the ways that he needed to, and that's carried over straight away to the NBA. Now, you did say something earlier, though. You said the one thing the Thunder really don't have is that kind of 6'8", 6'9", long-armed defender. What do they have that helps compensate for that? Like, is there could this be one of those matchups with Giannis Antetokounmpo where it exposes the fact that they don't have that player right now, and that all, like, Wallace and Caruso, all due respect to those guys, they're all incredible, but maybe that is one missing piece.
Yeah, I mean, how they compensate for it is that they have these, like, ultra competitive guards that have long arms and can stay on wings. And while they don't have like these wing size guys, I think the Thunder and the front office like really believe that those guys defend as just as well as a 6'8 guy could.
Can Chet be that too, Andrew? Like when Chet returns later in the season, and let's say he's playing in two big lineups with Hartenstein.
Yeah.
Can Chet be more of that big, long-armed perimeter guy in that role?
I actually think he can. I think a lot of teams thought they could put him on an island. Last year, they would try to get the Chet switch out to the perimeter, and he held up really well. I think that they want to explore the thought of him being like a four and what that could look like. I think they know that some of their best lineups are with him at five, just because it is so hard to match up with the Thunder when he's at five, because he can
five out on offense and rim protection on defense.
Yes, and the fact that he can put the ball on the floor too and create a little bit on his own. I mean, it's just impossible to stop. But I do think that they want to explore like being this giant team, which they haven't done. You know, we haven't seen this team play big. They very rarely went to the Jay Will Chet lineups last year. And I think that will change whenever Chet comes back, because Hartenstein is just different. He's bigger, he's a little bit more skilled. He's just he's been really good for OKC. And so I think that yes, I think we will see Chet as like a quote unquote wing out there at some point. I don't know how much they'll use it. I think that they will probably use the opportunity whenever Chet comes back to kind of slowly work him back in. And they'll have that opportunity just because they have Hartenstein. But I think that we will see that. And I don't know what that looks like. I'm really just intrigued to watch it.
Now, I mean, what is the timeline for him? Have they given any estimate at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thought, at least in my head, is that he'll probably be back post All-Star break. I think that he's going to play in a big chunk of games before the season's over. You know, he's standing on his own feet again. He didn't have to have the crutches at all times. I think that he's pretty close to not being on crutches anymore. It's just
he
a strain
to Vegas too. Like he's with the team.
Yeah, he's
Vegas
here. He was
well.
In the locker room the other night. And so that's a great sign, because he hadn't really traveled all that much. He'd kind of been bedridden for a little bit, and he's in really good spirits. I think that as long as he heals, which is, it's such a weird NBA injury. You know, when you look up the injury that he had, it's more of like a car crash injury, than it is like a sports injury. And so, and also, we're talking about a guy who's 7 feet tall, you know, lanky. There's probably not been a ton of people in the history of humanity that look like him that have had this specific injury. So I just don't know. I think the expectation or the hope is that he's back and can play in 20 to 30 games before the playoffs. But all that really depends on his body reacting in the way that is expected.
Now, I see in the background you have a T-Mobile Arena. You are in Las Vegas. Much better than my blurred background while I go through a move back here with a bunch of boxes behind me. you win the background battle today, and I lose most of them for now. Just you wait. A great background is coming. I'm curious. I was there last year in Vegas for the first year. It wasn't even called the NBA Cup yet. Still the in-season tournament. The NBA Cup, what's been the vibe around the games on these off days? We're recording this on Monday. What's Sunday and Monday? Like, do you feel like there's a buzz from NBA fans at all? Or is this just all hardcore fans on social media? Like, what's the impression in Vegas that you're feeling?
On game day, it was great. There were a ton of NBA fans everywhere on the streets. I thought it was a very, very fun environment. There are a lot more when the NBA did not get the Golden State Warriors or the Knicks. I was like, okay. I was at that point, I was so intrigued to see what it looks like. Are there enough fans going to show up? Is this place going to be dead? What does this look like? Fans showed up. And the arena looked really bad at the start of the first game. It was a 1:30 tip Pacific. But by the end of Atlanta, Milwaukee is actually a pretty good crowd. And then I thought the crowd for Thunder Rockets was actually pretty good. But I'll tell you this, yesterday, just walking the streets of Vegas, you'd have no clue there was an NBA event happening out there. There were a lot more football jerseys. I walked up and down the street. We were filming something, and I was looking for NBA jerseys. And KLC, try to guess how many NBA jerseys I saw in the course of 4 hours.
I'll take the under on whatever the over under is. I'm going to take the under in a total of three.
I won't even make you guess who it was. It was actually a teal Cade Cunningham jersey.
Wow. That I saw. That's so random.
It was super random. That was the only NBA jersey I saw.
A Pistons fan buying that ticket, he sure as hell knew that there wasn't going to be the Detroit playing there.
Yeah, I don't even know if he's going to be at the game tomorrow. That was a little strange, but overall, I've been really impressed with the people that have shown up. I'm just so intrigued to hear people's stories about like why, when they decided to buy the tickets and how they decided to be here. And so I stop and talk to fans. It's funny. I actually had a connecting flight in Houston from Oklahoma City on Saturday. And so I flew to Houston and there were a ton of Rockets fans on that plane with me. And so I just was wanting to talk to all of them. Like, okay, like tell me about, you know, your fandom with the Rockets and why you decided to fly to Vegas for this. And, you know, people are very excited about the NBA Cup. I talked to some Thunder fans yesterday that are from New Zealand that flew from New Zealand just to come to the NBA Cup. So people are showing up for this, and I've been impressed. I thought the crowd didn't quite know what to do at the beginning of the game. And part of that was, it was so quiet. It was so quiet in the arena to start the game. And part of that was they weren't playing music. You know, usually there's music just playing all the time. You know, a different song for each team as they're bringing the ball up the court.
Too much music.
Cut it
down. I'm anti-music during gameplay, but that's a different topic.
I turned to Joe Vardon, who's sitting next to me, my colleague, and I was like, Joe, I can hear a pin drop in here right now. But he's like, look at the stands. Like the stands are full. It was just that I don't think, you know, fans really knew how to react in this neutral site environment because it was probably 50-50 with the fans, maybe like a little bit in favor of OKC for Rockets Thunder.
Was it full in the lower bowl or how about the upper bowl as well?
Yeah, they were both pretty full. Okay. I was impressed. I thought this could be 60% full or something like that. That's kind of was my expectation just because it's like last minute. How many Thunder and Rockets fans can you actually get to this game? But there were a lot. You know, people showed up. I have friends of mine, like a few of my like college friends are flying in to watch the Cup Championship. They fly in today and they're like super pumped to go watch the Thunder. And so I do think that I was very skeptical. I honestly thought this wouldn't work as far as like a non-Lakers, non-Warriors, non-Knicks team, you know, actually filling the arena. But, you know, my expectation is that it'll be full tomorrow and it'll be full of small market fans, which I think is pretty great if you're the NBA.
I mean, I was high on the NBA Cup before last season, just because I think these little, you know, quote unquote gimmicks are better than the standard regular season in October, November, December. Like, yeah, I think totally. It's just a step up from that. And over the course of time, my expectation is that this thing will grow. Like, yeah. Summer League was not what it was today, even just 5, 6, 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. When I first started going to, I think my first Summer League was 2014 or 2015. It was not anywhere as busy as it's been the last 2, 3, or 4 years. That thing has grown a lot to become kind of like NBA Coachella. Mm-hmm. And so I think over the course of time, maybe the NBA Cup could become a place that, you know, fans that aren't even fans of either team might decide to go to for a weekend in Vegas. I think the scheduling needs work. Like Saturday to Tuesday, that's too long, the two days between the games. The NBA needs to figure that out somehow. Maybe even if like you have the losers play on one of the off days, something like that, just to fill a day, or even have some other teams come. I don't know. Like, I just think having more teams maybe brings more fans, and then therefore you have like a bigger event that fills the whole weekend. Because these two off days is, I don't know, it's a bit much. I think in Vegas, from my standpoint on media, it was just weird being there for that long. It's like, okay. That's all? 2 days off?
Yeah, it feels like,
and we're strange.
Yeah, we're recording this on Monday. It feels like the game should be today. You know, like that's it has that feel to it. But what's also funny about the scheduling is that something that Thunder fans always do after a playoff game is that they will go to the airport after a road playoff game and meet the team at the airport and like cheer them on and welcome them back home. But what's funny about this, and this is like a scheduling thing that the NBA is going to have to figure out because this is a mess. The Thunder have to be in Orlando on Thursday. And so they're not even going to go home. So they've got to fly from Vegas to Orlando and they play a back-to-back. They play Orlando on Thursday. They play Miami on Friday. And so this is just like a scheduling just disaster for teams that make it this far. And like, obviously the Thunder want to win this thing, but I think there was always also this piece of it where it's like, hey, we absolutely want to win it. That would be great. But it could be rough. And I think that Thunder fans like should have the expectation that after, I think some of the air is going to get let out of the balloon a little bit after this cup final, because like there's so much like energy and effort and everything that goes into this. And then like, hey, you know what? You got to go play real games again. And you don't get a break before you go do that. And in fact, you have to go play a back-to-back right out of this. I think it's going to be really tough. And I think that's something the NBA has to figure out, because I think the same would have happened for like the Warriors had a really tough road schedule if they would have made it here. Like it's not just a Thunder thing. The NBA is going to have to figure out how to deal with this. Also, I would say, I think the winner of the cup should count on their regular season, yes, by the way.
And the why loss, does it not?
The loss shouldn't count. I will say the loss shouldn't count for the team that loses, but I think absolutely the win should count. You should get that, you know, you get the money, that's great. But if the team that wins gets like an extra win, and we all know that, especially in the West and at the top of the East, it's going to matter. You know, just an extra win matters a whole lot. So count it. Why don't we count it?
It should count. It's ridiculous that it doesn't count. It makes no sense to me. I know the cash prize is awesome for the players, and hopefully over the course of time, tradition builds and this becomes awesome for the fans as well. And I think it is. Like, I think for OKC or Milwaukee on Tuesday, they're going to celebrate it. It's going to, for the Bucks, it would feel like, oh, we are fully back from this horrible start to the season. We are contenders. We beat the best team in the West. That's what it would be. For the Thunder, it's look at us. Best record in the West, and we won the NBA Cup. We don't even have Chet. We are the favorite in the West. Let's go, baby. This is something to signal who we are and we're here. It's something that matters, and that'll build over time. But the extra win sure would be nice, because then it makes it count more towards the standings and seeding, and it matters for the playoffs. I'm anti, you know, oh, the winner of the Cup should get the fifth best draft odds or something like that. I'm against that. But to me, I think, like, let's say when we expand to 32 teams at some point, Vegas is added, Seattle is added, whatever the teams are. I think it would be sick, 32 team, single elimination, and each win in the tournament counts double. So like a cup win would count as two. Now, that's down the line. There's counter arguments to that, that it devalues the rest of the regular season, that the cup games matter too much. I understand the counter arguments of something like that. But I just think these games, if you make them matter more, and if it's just the championship that gives you double win, two wins towards the standings or whatever, so be it. I think that it should factor in. Why does it not? It feels like a big oversight to me.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it's bizarre.
Very strange, especially when, like you said, you got a back-to-back right out of this.
Yeah.
So weird. So weird.
Yeah.
Andrew, one last question. You're from Oklahoma, right?
Yeah. Yeah, born and raised.
So who did you grow up rooting for in the NBA when OKC wasn't in existence? Just curious.
I was a big Shaq guy. Shaquille O'Neal fan, like since like the early 90s, like that. I remember watching him when he was with the Magic and just like, who is that guy? Like, what's this guy all about?
So like and Magic, it, Lakers, the, like, did you follow Shaq in his career, or did you stay as like a Lakers fan at one point?
There's a place in my office where I have like all my NBA jerseys that I had as a kid, like hanging up, and there's like every single Shaq jersey is hanging up in there. In fact,
when did it stop? Do you have like a Suns Shaq jersey, a Celtics Shaq?
I do. Quick story. So when I was in college, Shaq was coming through when he was with Phoenix, and he was doing this Feed the Children fundraiser, and it was with it was a peanut butter fundraiser. So they wanted to get as much peanut butter in this short amount of time as they could. And so there was this contest to whoever brought the most peanut butter to this event got like this big grand prize. And so all my friends knew that I was a huge Shaq fan. And so this was back whenever like Facebook groups was a thing. And so I created this Facebook group about me trying to get all this peanut butter. And
what kind of ask is this? Bring the most peanut butter?
Yeah, I'm telling you. Okay, so at the time, you could return peanut butter to like Walmart or whatever, and they would give you cash. And so I figured out where the cheapest peanut butter was. Shout out to Aldi. And the people would bring me like big jars of like premium peanut butter. I'm like, that's so nice, but I don't need that. What I need is quantity. And so I would take it back, I would get the money, and then I would go buy out Aldi of all their peanut butter. There's this one location in OKC where people could not get peanut butter for weeks because I would walk in and I would buy all of it. And so I ended up with 535 jars of peanut butter.
Who was second place? How many did they have?
I don't know.
20? 20? You went over the top?
Listen, I don't know. I don't know who got second place, but
nobody else showed up with any, right? Because you bought it all.
I was bound and determined to win this thing. I won it. And so I have this big signed Shaq Phoenix Suns jersey hanging in my office. That's why I have a Phoenix Suns Shaq jersey. So, huge Shaq fan to say the least.
It's incredible. Oh man, geez. Have you ever spoken to Shaq, interviewed him, told him that story?
I mean, obviously when I won the contest, I spoke to him, but I have not had a chance to speak with him since. Would love to talk to him about that. I'm sure he does not remember that at all, but it was a ridiculous time. And just like, I felt like I was walking on clouds, man. That was just like one of the best days ever.
You gotta get Shaq on Down to Dunk and ask him whose idea it was. Peanut butter? What? Is this your idea, Shaq?
I have a t-shirt that says the Peanut Butter Shaq Challenge on it.
Oh my God. Feels like his idea. Let's see what idiot shows up with the most peanut butter.
That's this guy right here.
Andrew, where can we find your stuff?
Yeah, go listen to the Athletic NBA Daily. It's a show that posts every single morning. It's really fun. It's just a quick recap of everything that happens in the league, hosted by my guy Dave Dufour. And then my show, the Saturday Slam and Jam, posts every Saturday on that feed. And then if you want more Thunder content, go listen to Down to Dunk.
Awesome, Andrew. You do amazing work. Thank you for joining today. Thanks again to Andrew Schleck. Coming up, we have at Ball Don't Stop. Akam Nagra is his real name, but you probably know him as Ball Don't Stop over on social media. If you follow the NBA at all on X or Instagram or anywhere on the interwebs, because Ball Don't Stop is everywhere. This guy is known in two different categories, really. For one, NBA players, and a lot of people really like him because of his breakdowns of the game, his strong opinions about scoring and the pureness of scoring. He runs a pro-am up in Vancouver, Canada, which is where he's based. Guys like Peyton Pritchard have been there, Scottie Barnes, Will Barton. Very respected in the Vancouver area, in the basketball community up there. On the other hand, a lot of people don't love Ball Don't Stop because he's super opinionated about the way the game is played. He does not love the analytics movement at all. He's very anti-analytics, does not like the spreadsheets or the calculators, as he says. He much prefers pure hoopers. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring him on today of all days. We just saw the Mavericks and the Warriors break the record for most made threes with 48 over the weekend. It's perfect timing to bring going on. Ball don't stop. So I really enjoyed our conversation, and it was actually our first time ever speaking. We had never met in person, never even DM'd on social for that matter. So it was our first time chatting, and we went through a lot. Recent games, the draft a little bit, trade that happened, Dennis Schroeder going to the Warriors, and some other stuff as well. So here's my conversation with Akam Nagra, aka Ball Don't Stop. All right, here with Ball Don't Stop, Akam Nagra. Ball Don't Stop. I don't know what to call you. It's our first time talking together, though. How are you doing today, man?
I'm good, man. I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Akam. So today we're going to play a little game. We're going to hit a bunch of different topics. And because you're my guest, the theme is going to be shooting threes. We're going to be doing topics in groups of three. So we're going to start out with the NBA Cup. I already talked a lot about the Oklahoma City Thunder with Andrew Schleck. So I want to start off with a question about their opponent, the Milwaukee Bucks. Dame and Giannis, they seem to be really trending up in recent weeks. Giannis is obviously performing at an MVP level. Damian Lillard seems to be accepting that role as the number two. In what ways have you seen them continue to ascend this season? And what are some of the ways that you still think that they can further improve to better position the Bucks when it comes to playoff time compared to NBA Cup time right now?
Yeah, you know, I see a major improvement in that duo on the fact that they're playing off each other more. Giannis and Dame were a tricky fit, you know, when they made that move, because you realize that Giannis is a guy that likes to be on the ball. He needs to come downhill. He needs the middle of the floor. He needs to bring that up, right? And Dame, throughout his whole basketball career, as a pro, as even going back to college, high school, that is his spot, bringing the ball up the floor, walking it down, plays at a whole different tempo, right? And he likes to control the action, get in the pick and roll. Those two styles, like when Dame got traded last year, there was no training camp. Was it right before training camp?
Yeah, right before it happened real quick.
So like they were on the fly figuring it out. Now you see them and like you said, Dame, the second role, like he was down to do that. He was open to doing that for years. It had to be for the right superstar. And Giannis is the most dominant player in the league right now. You know, when you talk about production, when you talk about get to the rim, when you talk about consistent dominance and whatever he does, it's going to happen every single night. You know, you pick the over on Giannis, 30 a night. Dame is now able to play off that. You see him kind of, you know, drift away, become like a two guard in those moments. And they're kind of reading each other a little bit more. You know, there's still some moments where they're off beat, but I feel like Dame has settled into, okay, I need to operate in, you know, on three dribbles, I got like 5 seconds to make a move, get into my combos. It's not like Portland where I'm going to dribble, you know, feel out the whole game. He has to attack quick and he has to play off him because Giannis has one thing on his mind. That's to attack. That's to come downhill. So I see them playing a lot better. I also think Doc Rivers has integrated more there now. You know, you see them.
That's playing big, man.
Yep. Play the two-man game a lot.
The rotation changes that he made have been critical in helping those two.
Yep. Playing the two-man game a lot. You see them, you know, a lot of DHO, a lot of pick and roll with those two. That just gets Dame into a rhythm early so that he's able to make shots later in games when he hasn't shot the ball or touched the ball for 3, 4, 5, 6 possessions in a row, right? That's the key. And I think Doc's an old school coach, right? Like he did this with CP3 and Blake Griffin. So I see him implementing some of that. Obviously, those are different players, but it looks good right now. You know, they're producing, they're able to put up. What are they averaging right now as a duo? I don't know the exact number, but they seem to be getting up there in the 50s, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. They've definitely made progress. It just looks like they're blending together more, and the rotation changes are helping a lot there in Milwaukee. I think it's going to be a great game on Tuesday. Do you have a prediction between the Bucks and the Thunder?
Yeah, I actually think, man, Giannis is playing with a different type of mentality right now. Seems like he's back on his like everything. Sorry for the cursing, but like he's going
we'll bleep it out.
Okay, he is the way and Boston, this is the thing with Boston is like, and the Thunder, these are great defenses, right? No matter how good they are defensively, I've never seen someone, unless you make a wall, stop Giannis from getting in the paint repeatedly again and again and again. And that's why it's so important for the Bucks to have shot makers around that. And it's so important for Dame to be ready to catch and shoot. I think the Bucks are gonna make a statement and win this game on Tuesday.
I agree. I had the Bucks winning it ahead of the NBA Cup. I originally had them beating the Mavericks. Did not expect the Thunder to beat that hot Mavericks team, but here we are. And I think it's gonna be a great game. I have the Bucks winning it though as well. All right, Akam, our second question in this first group, the Atlanta Hawks, they lose to the Bucks. They've had some really impressive defensive stretches throughout this past month. Dyson Daniels has been tremendous. Jalen Johnson looks like a most improved player of the year. Trae Young, playmaking on offense at a really high level, 12 assists per game, even though his scoring is a bit down right now. Atlanta feels like they're developing an identity, and the team's making sense around Trae Young. But I'm curious, as you watch this team make progress, what do you think's missing for them? Like, what do they need to do, or is it something internal? What's missing from the Hawks right now?
Yeah, you know, I think they need another scorer, an extra Trae, another guy that could put the ball on the floor, get to a spot, take more pressure. Because, like, these young guys that you just named, great, crazy upside, athletic, long. They, you know, they've put size around Trae Young. They've put athleticism around him. And this is great for today's NBA, right? It's all 3-and-D. It's space the floor. Who can close out? Who can crash the boards? Who can cut guys off repeatedly? That team is doing that. That's why they're competitive right now. But when they get down into those later months of the season in April and May into the playoffs, you know, as games slow down, Trae is going to, first of all, have to up his scoring again, right? Because these young guys are raw. They haven't had that experience of, you know, playoff pressure. You know, I think DeAndre Hunter, he has to take another step as well still. But I think
he's been really good as of late, man. Like he looks like the guy they need lately.
Yeah, but yeah. If he could replicate what he's been doing lately come playoff time, maybe they don't need much more. But I do think they need someone next to Trae that can get 25, get 25, explode for 30, be the lead scorer on any given night, you know, be a shot maker. And when you start talking about, you know, I said Ingram might be an awkward fit because they got so many wings. They'd have to get rid of one of those or two of those guys. But, you know, I feel like they're going to need – because Trae, I feel like the Hawks kind of failed him after that 2021 run. Like he was great on that run. You know, they caught some breaks and got there. I felt like if they haven't put him with an all-star level guy that could say, hey, I'm going to take pressure off you tonight and be the best player on the floor.
DeJounte Murray? Does he not count?
No, I don't think he's
too much overlap that being two smaller guards.
Two small guards. They're kind of the same back. Like that backcourt couldn't defend. And DeJounte Murray's not really like a shot maker. You know, I would think maybe a Zach LaVine would be better in that role because, Zach, he'll hit six threes. He doesn't need to really dribble. He can get... You know, again, it's the same thing defensively, but Zach would be a better fit playing off of Trae. I feel like Ingram as well.
I feel you there because with LaVine versus Murray. Murray is, you know, a guy who is the nine or ten assist guy, a game guy. LaVine can be that off ball bucket getter, coming off handoff screens, cutting all that stuff, lob threat himself too. Ingram's interesting for Atlanta. I hadn't thought a lot about Ingram for Atlanta because, as you said, A, the Hawks already have a ton of wings, right? And B, I think about Ingram, maybe it's a winning team that might want to go get him more. But it could also just be a team that's kind of in a transitional phase. Like Atlanta, they're not a contender right now, but they're also like pretty competitive.
He could be the piece that gets you maybe if it clicks. And again, it takes a lot. There's a lot of moving parts in today's NBA for things to click. If Ingram and Trae can be, you know, what's a duo like that? What do we have? What's another guard wing duo in the league right now? Let's say Kyrie and KD on the Nets a couple years ago. Let's see if they can replicate a little bit of that, 75% of that. I think that's a good combo if they can learn to play off each other, especially when games settle down. You know, Ingram had a horrible playoff performance showing last year. Lou Dort was on him. You know, he clamped his shit up, but... You know, then you look back to when Ingram was in a winning situation when the Pelicans made that first playoff run. He played really well. You know, I think that was
against
that
the Suns.
Yeah, against the Suns.
27, 28 points per game on elite efficiency. Yeah. He was incredible.
It's crazy. And you know, that Ingram, the one that I saw in those six games, I felt like I'd be comfortable matching him up with any wing in the league if you get that version of Ingram. You know, and when I say any wing in the league, I feel like, you know, if there's a Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown or Kevin Durant on the floor, I'm saying, Ingram, go do your thing. Go match these guys because I feel like he's capable of doing that on the right night. But, you know, it's a new scenery he needs. And I feel like Atlanta, they're doing all the other shit. They're defending. They're playing up and down. Ingram's motor. Sometimes I question Ingram's motor, right? Does he want it? Is he like that? Is he going to bring it every single night? I feel like Atlanta, I don't know what they'd lose if they go get him, but I feel like Atlanta has everything else right now. They literally just need a guy that could come in and get 22, 23, 24 a night. And I think Brandon's a great guy for that because he fits what they are in terms of their length, what the direction they're going, you know, the size. But it's exactly what they need is a pure scorer.
Reese Ishay, Daniels, yep. Ingram. I mean, mm-hmm. like the list would be pretty endless with their amount of wings. DeAndre yep. Hunter. Mm-hmm. And I think salary-wise, they could, you know, maybe you have to add something, but perhaps not because he's an upcoming free agent. But Onyeka Okongwu and Bogdan Bogdanovic would work salary-wise. I'm into that idea for Atlanta. I think it's worth the roll of a dice of the dice if the New Orleans Pelicans would rather take a gamble on Okongwu as well. And by the way, I think Okongwu is worthy of a gamble for the New Orleans Pelicans for the same reason. So our third question in this first group of questions here, the Rockets, they lost 111-96 on Saturday in the NBA Cup. Had a mailbag question related to this from Peter. Pete asked for his topic here. He's like, hey, you know, the Rockets, they've become his favorite league pass team to watch this season. What are they going to do to maximize what they already have, though? And so to kind of add on to Pete's question here, I'm curious if this NBA Cup loss to the Thunder in your eyes kind of exposed just how far away they are from actual title contention. Is it less about maximizing what they are this season and more about figuring out who they are in the grand scheme of things over the next 2-3 years?
Yeah, you know, I think Sengun might be a top three big man in the game right now. Top three, top
right
four.
Right now, already.
Top three, top four, top five. On his best night, Sengun can get to that level. And I think Van Vliet, Ime Udoka, like these guys brought some type of veteran mentality, the squad, they brought in some order. Offensively, they look a little bit better, but Jalen Green has to play better, bro. And that's the next step for them. You know, Jalen Green is being counted on to be a star. They're giving him the ball. He's getting a lot of shots. His minutes are up there. If Green can be that 1-2 punch with Sengun every night where it's a, you could pencil in him for 20, 22 a night, this Rockets ceiling goes way, way higher.
Why is he not that? He's had stretches like that end of last season where he's dropping 25, 30 in just banger games. And then he has these stinker stretches, 9 points against the Wolves, 12 against the Warriors, 5-14 against the Thunder on Saturday, where it's like, who is this guy? I just don't understand why he has these highs and these lows. Like, what is missing from him? Is it system? Is it him? Like, what do you think the problem is?
I think it's a mix, right? Like, when you brought in Van Vliet's a guy now that is, yeah, he's going to be a floor general. He's going to run the offense a bit. That's a guy that likes to shoot the ball. That's a guy that likes to make decisions for himself as well. Now, I don't consider Jalen a shooter, right? I don't know what the percentages say. He's not a shooter.
31% from three this season. Yeah, so 33% in his career. And that's despite being 80% from the line in his career. So we know he has touch from the line. We know he has touch near the basket, but it has not yet translated from three. Is that a lower body issue? Is that like a strength issue?
Yeah, I feel like, first of all, his form, when I see him shoot, his elbow is like way out here. So he doesn't have a shooter's mechanics. He's a scorer. Think Jordan Poole. Think Cam Thomas. He's like those guys where he needs a rhythm to get going. And if he's in his bag, he's getting to the rim. He's playing in the pick and roll. You know, he gets a few layups. He catches a lob. Then you see him explode for 25-30, right? Last year, that stretch he had, Rockets weren't really winning games. It was the end of the year. They had nothing to lose. So he kind of took over there. But, you know, when you look at that, legs, I think, you know, there might be a mechanical issue with his shot, maybe a little bit. You know, Jalen,
he hasn't gained much muscle, man. Like, yeah, his body does not look much different since his rookie year. He hasn't. Most guys get stronger visibly. Like, you can see it. Jalen Green looks the same.
Yeah. And yeah, for sure. He does need to get stronger. But also another thing with Jalen is he's like a Ferrari. He's so high speed. If you look at him when he blows by guys, I think if he learns to control his pace a little bit better, like if you look at De'Aaron Fox, right? De'Aaron Fox is a freak athlete as well. And we saw as the years went on, he started playing a little bit more of a slower game, playing with pace, picking his spots. you know, attacking out of triple threat, using his speed the right way. I think Jalen just has to figure that out, man. And once he does that, I think his game will be a little bit cleaner. I also think he might have to go the route of a Shea, where it's like, yo, I'm just going to shoot mid-ranges and get my three going through that. There's no way Jalen Green could start off games catch and shoot three. That's just not his game. He's not a three-point specialist. This is a guy that needs to get downhill. This is a guy that needs to attack the basket. This is a guy that needs to get little floaters and runners going in the paint. And then from there, everything opens up. But trying to do that now within this system, they started winning. Sengun needs his touches. You know, Jabari Smith, Van Vliet, you got guys that are there that also need the ball. I don't know, man. I don't know. Maybe they need to trade him. Let him go flourish. Let him go be the guy somewhere else and bring in another guy that's just going to be – because if they had a 3-and-D guy right now that was just catch and shoot, making threes, it'd look real good right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, Jalen Green, to your point, he's not a catch-and-shoot guy. He probably should be, but he's not. I'm also not sure he's a pull-up guy either from mid-range. Like, he's 25% on pull-up twos this year. He's 34% on pull-up twos last year. I don't know. Like, he's had stretches where he's on fire and he's nonstop. To your point, maybe it's a rhythm thing. Maybe the reason why the percentages are low is because, like, some games he gets one shot, other games he's getting 10. And maybe if he gets more games where he's getting 10, he's putting up better numbers, because some guys are like that. But he needs to be better. Otherwise, I think he's very clearly the odd man out. Our next category is games. Over the weekend, the Mavericks and Warriors broke a record. 48 combined made three-pointers. 95 of the 190 attempted shots came from three-point range. That's half if you don't do much math. 95 out of 190. 74 shots came in the paint. Only 21 shots came from deep mid-range. Ball don't stop. Was this game a pure Hooper's worst nightmare?
Yeah. You know, look, honestly, I love the three ball.
Did you break your TV watching the game?
No, I didn't break my TV. But
did you turn it off?
Yeah, no. There's a lot of talent on the floor. There's a lot of respectable stars and shooters on the floor where it made sense, right? This is the thing, right? Like, this is the NBA now. These guys they're driven by analytics. This is what they're being told to do. This is what the coaches are being told to do. And it's not going to change until there's rule changes to counter that. Last night, like, the Mavs and Doves, I'm okay with them shooting that many threes because they have real shooters on the floor, proven guys on the floor. Their system is geared for those shooters. You know, that makes sense. When you're aimlessly chucking up shots, when you got seven-footers that shouldn't probably be shooting those threes at that high of a, you know, a frequency, that's when it's an issue, you know. And I think that's where the fan tunes out. When you have Kyrie, Luka, Steph, Klay, these guys on the floor, when you have a proven system like the Warriors that created that style for this modern day, pretty much, when you have a team like the Mavs, that then it's all right, then it's cool, then it doesn't look as bad. You don't feel, you know, you don't, like, I didn't watch that saying, yo, they took, how many was it, 95 threes, because yo, a lot were going in, right? Made sense.
Yeah, it was 95 out of 190, and you're right. It does make more sense for those types of teams. Yeah. Your issue is typically with the teams that should not be taking that many.
Exactly. However, and it's a style thing, right? Like, there's my issue with – I love where the NBA is at talent-wise. I love where the NBA is at, you know, athletically, skill-wise, probably at an all-time high. You know, the depth of talent, all-time high. The issue becomes when everyone's playing the same way, you know, because what made the NBA great was different styles, you know, different schemes, how you, you know, it was like boxing. How do you prepare for this guy? How do you prepare for this coach? The NBA was built on basketball minds like Hubie Brown, you know, like Lenny Wilkins, Larry Brown. Like, these were the old school coaches that Pat Riley, Phil Jackson, that had an influence on how the league played, right? Everyone had different styles. For the most part, everyone had different offenses. I think there was a great balance of post-play, mid-range, three-ball, isolation, pick-and-roll, all that. And I think what's happened now is they've gotten away from that, and it's more so – it's all analytics-driven, so it's all data-driven. And that's why you see guys on a three-on-one fast break, pull it back out, shoot a three, right? Because this is what's being pushed. This is what's being pushed to the coaches, and it's what's being pushed on the players, and it's what's being pushed to the player development, right? So,
and it's what works. It's what works too. Because of the way the rules are structured. That's why Boston wins it all. Mm-hmm, that's why the Warriors and the Rockets and these teams started shooting in front of the freeze. Yep. It works with the current rules.
It works. And it's putting up points. They've fully optimized what NBA basketball is, right? That's what it is. This is what you do when you have five guys, Boston, when you have five guys on the perimeter that can make a play, that could get to the rim, and that could shoot the three ball. It's going to be hard to stop that if they're in sync, right? This whole issue with the analytics and the threes and all that, it's only going to be fixed if you alter the rules, if you switch up and counter this. And I've talked about it. Maybe you let the big camp in the paint for three in the key, remove that rule, no three in the key. You know, maybe you allow a little bit of a hand check. Maybe you allow a little bit of a physicality because they're not letting guys touch each other. Like, it's a lot, man. It's a deep issue, but I'm not. I have no real beef with the Mavs and the Dubs shooting that many threes because they have the shooters to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to people arguing with you on social media about, you know, your stance on this, and then they say, well, no. There are different styles. There are teams that run a heavy dose of pick and rolls, and then there are teams that don't. There are teams that play super fast, and then there are teams that try to slow things down, and there are teams that run things through the elbows, and there's teams like with a Jokic, and there's teams with an Embiid, and then there's teams that run five out and they move the ball side to side. I think there are a lot of people who would argue that there are a lot of different styles. I think to your point, the results are very flat from some of those styles. And a lot of the whatever the action is, the goal of that action is to get penetration for a kick out.
Yeah,
and so I think that is where you come from. And some people would say, well, getting into that, it might be different, which is true. I think they're right as well. But I do think, like, when I talk to some of my friends who are more not hardcore NBA fans, I think hardcore NBA fans are going to watch no matter what. But like the people who like will tune in here and there, a lot of my friends who are in that category say, I don't know, it just feels a bit more, you know, all the same. Like that's one of the complaints. The other complaint all the time is the officiating, how long reviews take. Another one is start times of games. They're like, I don't know, I tune in at 7:30 for a game and then it's 7:45 and it hasn't started yet.
Yep.
That's the other one. So I think there's a number of like easy fixes for the NBA. Start time is easy. You know, let's use some artificial intelligence to make the officiating job of refereeing is not easy. Let's make their jobs easier by quickening that process. The tough one is the rules. I do not know the clear solution there because there's always side effects to decisions you make there. Second one from our games category, LeBron James. He made his return on Sunday night. The Lakers beat the Grizzlies 116-110. LeBron had a massive dunk in the game. Everybody talked about that on social, saying he got his juice. He's back. He had 18 points on 17 shots, but AD was the dominant one. 40 points on 22 shots. Fouled Triple J out of the game, who had six fouls. The Grizzlies, in this individual night against the Lakers, just one game, they looked a step below them with LeBron playing at that level and AD playing at that level. Do you think that that's actually the case in reality when it comes to stacking up these teams together? Or is this just one individual game?
Well, what did the Lakers do against the Grizzlies a few years ago?
Beat them up.
Yeah, they beat them up.
Beat them up.
LeBron and AD are from that older NBA. You know, they're from that half court, pound the ball, you know, bully ball. When games slow down, this Lakers team always looks better come playoff time for the most part. I'm not saying they're a title contender. I'm not saying they're a Western Conference contender, but you saw them make that run in 2023. And it's because you start playing a brand of basketball that is more complementary to your two lead guys. Your low post presence in Anthony Davis, mid to low post. He's all of a sudden now, the game has tightened up. AD's at the block, controlling the entire defense, anchoring it. Guys are scared to get into the paint. Everything is slower. Even LeBron. LeBron is 40 years old. He do not have the energy to rotate and the attention span to the amount of high-level games this guy's played in. There's no way in today's high-octane high movement, young, high energized NBA that LeBron is going to be putting in A plus effort defensively every single possession, every single night. It's not even going to happen. You'd be lucky to get a C plus out of him. The Lakers just need to get to the playoffs. The Lakers need to be a top six seed so they don't end up in a play-in and lose. And the Lakers need to go up against one of these young teams and do what they do. And I think in that case, if the Grizzlies and the Lakers were going to go up against each other right now in a seven-game series, if it was a 3-versus-6 matchup, I would have to still pick the Lakers because LeBron and AD are much more dominant players when games settle down. And the Grizzlies are a young team. Again, your traditional modern-day NBA team. Run and gun, shoot a lot of threes, young athletes. Can they really make shots? Can they really, you know, get stops when games settle down against this Lakers squad? I think it's their time. They probably would beat them now just because the experience. You know, Taylor Jenkins is a great coach. He'll figure that out. And the Lakers are a little bit – they're missing some pieces. But there's a lot of teams, if they were to face this Lakers squad in the playoffs, I don't care how many hiccups the Lakers are having right now, the Rockets included. The Grizzlies, I'm not going to say the Thunder, but there's a few teams. I'd pick the Lakers.
I think the Lakers would have to make a move to beat a lot of those teams.
Sure.
Grizzlies, sure. Maybe. I mean, the Grizzlies are young. Like, they still need Brandon, they need Bane to still get better over the course of the season. Jaren Jackson, I think the progress he's made seems pretty real. But Desmond Bane, by the end of the year, I think Bane is going to have a stretch where it makes these struggles feel like a distant memory. I trust Bane. I think he's a high level player, man. But if Bane is rolling, and if Ja Morant continues to play at the level that he can, if Zach Edey's able to stay healthy, I think Memphis in a series would beat the Lakers at this point.
But if the Lakers make a move, if the Lakers make a move and they get a third guy, you know how LeBron wants a guy that makes happen, and that was a goal with Westbrook. He looks at it, you know, this is a guy that's capable of getting me 20, 10, and 10. I feel like the Lakers are going to make a power move. I think we're going to look at it and say, that doesn't do much for us. If they, like, we keep talking about the Ingrams and the Levines and the Jimmy Butlers, like these guys, if they end up on a, I'm not saying Jimmy Butler's going to go there, but if they end up on the Lakers, let's just say that happens, and Ingram or a Levine end up there, you just put at worst, 17 to 18 a night in your offense and took a lot of pressure off LeBron James to create.
Absolutely. You did. And those pieces also fit.
Yeah.
They do fit.
Yes.
It's just a matter of how much do you want to gamble future assets when LeBron James might only have 1 year remaining. Like, so that's like the struggle for that Lakers front office. And I look forward to seeing how they develop clarity ahead of the February trade deadline. Our third games-related topic here. Let's go to college basketball. Dylan Harper hit a game winner on Saturday. They beat Seton Hall. It was a beautiful basket in transition. It was 63-63 down the stretch. Ball inbounded to him. Turned around his defender with a little nice in-and-out dribble. Pulled up from the deep right wing. Drained a three. Zero on the clock. Team going crazy. Dylan Harper. 6'6" point guard. He's now averaging 23.5 points per game, 5 boards, 4 assists per game. Talked about Dylan Harper a few weeks back on the podcast, and the topic was, can anybody push Cooper Flagg out of the number one spot as the top prospect in the 2025 draft? So I'm curious about your opinion here. In your eyes, can Dylan Harper surpass Cooper Flagg, and has he already, possibly?
Well, it'll depend on the team. Right. It'll depend on who has that top pick. Is it a team that needs a guard? Because Dylan Harper, he's nice. He can get down to, he's a lefty. He's got long wingspan. You know, I don't know if he's 6'6". He's listed as 6'6", but if he's actually a real 6'6" guard, you'll see when he steps on an NBA court if he's really 6'6". If he's a 6'6" point guard that's scoring the ball, and there's a squad, like, let's see, who are the bottom teams going to be? It's going to be the Wizards. It's going to be
New Orleans.
Yeah, it's going to be New Orleans. If there's a situation where they're like, yo, we want to build around this guy right here, I could see it happen for sure. I could see, because Dylan Harper can go in. Both these guys have a great feel for the game. Both these guys are pretty advanced for their age level in terms of their skill set, where they are, right? You know, I'm looking at Harper, the way he can break the defense down. I don't know if he's that athletic. where, you know, it's going to translate to the NBA and allow him to put up 18, 20, 20, 22 points right away. But I think he could definitely be – I don't think either of these guys are lead franchise guys, to be honest, Cooper or him.
Really?
No, I don't. So I don't think.
Are you looking in a different direction then, possibly? Because isn't that what you want to take with the number one pick? Is a guy that can be a franchise changer, or has at least a chance to be?
No, I think they could change the franchise, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying 4, 5, 6 years from now, I could see these guys being the second guy on their team, you know, as opposed to the lead guy. It's just the timing. It's just the class we're looking at, right? The NBA is tough, man. It's hot. Like that Dylan Harper's position is loaded. It's loaded with guards. Every night is a matchup. Every night someone's about to put 25 and 8 on your head. You know, can Dylan Harper come in right away for the first 2-3 years and manage that and go in and be effective? I think he definitely has the potential to. But, you know, Cooper Flagg, I look at Cooper Flagg. Again, another guy that I don't think he's the most athletic wing, but when I watch him play out a triple threat, you know, when I'm seeing him create off the dribble, make those turnaround jumpers, and defensively, I look at him like, at worst, Cooper Flagg is going to be a really good 3-and-D guy in the NBA, a really good 3-and-D guy on a good young team. If you put him – I mean, if Cooper Flagg ends up on a squad like the Nets, you know, and they trade
– in place of Ben Simmons, like you replace Ben Simmons with Cooper Flagg.
Think about it. Think about it, right?
Two Mingham DHOs with Cam Thomas. That'd be pretty sweet, right?
It'd be nice. So – it's more of a fit thing, man, but I'm still going Cooper Flagg. I like Dylan Harper's game. I love the demeanor that he plays with, but that guard position is scary stacked in the NBA right now, and this point guard is coming for your head every single night. I don't know if I'd risk it on a guard like that right now, and I love guards.
I think, to your point, I think that's a big one. The guard position is just, like, loaded. It's stacked. At this point, like, every team has a guard that they are – that's, like, their franchise guy, or that they're invested in, that they hope can be their franchise guy, or somebody that they're happy with for now. And somebody like Dylan Harper, like, you can be really good and still be, like, the 18th best point guard in the league,
yeah.
Right? Like, whereas Cooper Flagg, there's not a lot of Cooper Flagg types. Like, he could be an elite defender. He could be an all-defensive player. He's a great rebounder for his size. He's a screener. He's a finisher. He shows some go-to scoring ability. I just think, still, I feel like Cooper Flagg is the guy I'd want to bet on. Whereas it wouldn't shock me if, like, Dylan Harper, you know, maybe ends up a star and there's a little bit of regret. But I think Cooper Flagg is still going to be a really, really, really good player. He's very safe. So I still have him number one on my board now.
Yeah.
But we'll take a quick break. And then when we're back, we're going to talk about some trades and a bunch of other topics. All right, Akam, next topic, trades. So we have three trade topics to talk about here, starting off with an actual trade that happened over the weekend. Dennis Schroeder was traded to the Golden State Warriors from the Brooklyn Nets. Now, this one is very interesting because last week on the show, I mentioned how Schroeder has a fascinating stat, according to thinkingbasketball.net. He is number two in the NBA behind Jalen Brunson in time of possession. When he's on the floor for the Nets this season, he has possessed the ball for 47% of those minutes. Number two in the NBA behind Jalen Brunson. So he is a high usage player, 18 points per game, 7 assists, 39% from three for the Nets. He's been best season of his career. Now, Draymond Green had a quote on this trade, and Draymond said, "We have to adjust to him because he's bringing something that this team needs. To just make him fall in line with what we do, we'd be wasting our time. We need somebody that can do what we necessarily don't do, and I think that's what he'll be for us." Do you agree with Draymond's thoughts on this? Is Dennis Schroeder the type of piece that the Warriors are missing to reach the heights that they need to?
Well, is he going to start for them?
I don't think we know that yet for certain.
Because look, Dennis Schroeder, we've seen many different versions of Dennis Schroeder throughout his career. He's been a sixth man that comes off the bench, and his usage isn't that high with the ball, but he's still able to get to the rim, operate in, you know, 3-4 dribbles, make a move, create for somebody. I think we'll see more of that Dennis Schroeder because it's Steph's team. These guys go to that squad. They know who's, you know, they know as selfless as Steph is, you play off of Steph, you play to his rhythm and flow, you know. So Dennis right now is on a Brooklyn team that's probably tanking. It's probably why they've traded him, and possibly Cam Thomas is next, right? Because these guys were they were getting them wins that they were getting them wins that they weren't supposed to be getting them, right? And Schroeder was out there playing like it's Germany, you know. But I don't think he'll. I don't think Schroeder's the guy that you bring in and say like, hey, you do your thing, and because of you, we're gonna take another step. I think he's more of a spark plug off your bench. I think his true role in the NBA is, you know, come off and go for 14 to 16 in on any given night, make shots, take pressure, take time, give Steph a little breather, and still be there to close games and you know, break down the defense. Because that's what Dennis does. He has a long wingspan, you know, very quick, you know, sneaky, crafty player. But he's in attack mode. And when he's making shots, he was shooting the ball really well here in Brooklyn during this stretch. When he's doing those things, he's capable. But I think it's more towards the Jordan Poole thing, Kevin. I think this is literally that. It's you're going to do for us what Jordan Poole did for us a few years ago, and we got that back now. And I think that's what that is.
I think that's a good comparison for what they're looking for out of him. They're missing that pool spark. And granted, he's a different type of player. That's something that they're missing on that team. And plus, this is in part, look, dude, Pods was really good his rookie season. He has taken a big step back or two steps back.
Two, three steps back.
Yeah. Dude, like, yeah. He went from, oh, wait a minute, is he untradeable? How can the Warriors trade Pods? Yeah. You can't give up Pods for Lowry Markkanen. Mm-hmm. To, wait, this guy made a first-team all-rookie?
Crazy.
Like I got Rockets fans in my mentions, like, you're a dumbass for voting him over Amen Thompson for first team. I was like, wait a minute, like 70 people did that of 100 voters. Like, it was like close to consensus, agree or not. Pods was great his rookie season, but he's taken a big step back. He has not been able to fulfill that role you're talking about that Jordan Poole previously occupied. Schroeder can help fill that. The other interesting thing for this trade from the Warriors' perspective is the timing of it. They made this trade at a moment where he can be aggregated in deals. So February 5th, the day before the deadline, he's able to be aggregated in trades due to the timing of it. So from the time of you listening to this podcast, moving forward, players traded now cannot be aggregated in trades. But Schroeder was traded at a time where he could be. So the Warriors, they're going to continue to look for deals. I'm sure if LeBron James ended up saying, you know what, I want to leave LA and go play with Steph in Golden State, Schroeder might be headed to LA and a salary to make that deal work. But I'm just throwing that last thought out there for listeners to consider. I think they want to keep him. He helps them. But hey, it's nice to have the flexibility to possibly make
a trade. Experiment with it. They'll give it whatever these next 10, 15 games, and they'll know. And then from there, they'll see which direction they're going to go. I think that's a good ass point you made right there, man. Because the Warriors could be a whole different team the day after the trade deadline. And I think they are going to be, because this squad right now is not in position to win a chip, but it's right there where Steph and those guys, you know, that system, Kerr, it's intact again. They're firing. They're in the middle of the pack in the West, I think. Are they in the middle of the pack? This might be their last window, right, where this squad is kind of good enough. And if you get that right piece, Steph's going to do what Steph does come playoff time, and you might steal a series and catch the right break and end up in a finals again. You never know.
The Warriors right now, they're 14-11. They are tied with the Nuggets record-wise for the 5 seed. So it's so close there at that point. But they're 2.5 back from the 3 seed, only 3 back from the 2 seed. So, like, it is so tight in the West that a couple of those games, one way or the other, could swing the standings dramatically, whether they have home court or not in the first round. So I like this move for them. It helps them now in this tight race. Our next topic for trades, Jimmy Butler. More to talk about here, because Brian Windhorst over at ESPN said over the weekend that he said specifically, I know the Suns have interest in Jimmy Butler. Jimmy wants $100 million, and I think the Suns might give it to him. So I reported last week on Yahoo Sports that part of the reason all these rumors are coming out from Shams is because Jimmy Butler wants to get paid, and the Heat may not be wanting to give him what Jimmy Butler wants. So it sounds like Phoenix, according to Windhorst, would be willing to pay him. Now, I'm curious, Akam, why exactly would the Heat want Bradley Beal back in a trade here? Can you make the case for why the Heat would see appeal in trading Jimmy Butler for Bradley Beal?
Would it be Kevin Durant instead?
No.
Nope. That I could see.
Sorry, Pat Riley. Sorry. No, it's not Kevin Durant hanging up the phone on you.
Bradley Beal. I mean, you remember when Beal?
No, don't even ask about Devin Booker, Pat Riley. No,
I know. You know, Pat.
It's Bradley Beal or nothing.
I don't know. The Beal we see now is nowhere near the Beal we saw when he was leading the league in scoring three, four years ago.
It's a long time ago at this point.
Long time ago.
It feels like yesterday, but it was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. And I remember that Beal used to be linked to the Heat. There used to be rumors of the Heat might acquire Bradley Beal. You know better than me on that.
He admitted on a podcast that before he was traded to the Suns, his preference was Miami. So he openly has said his preferred destination was the Heat. So we know he's be open to waiving his no trade clause again to go.
Yeah,
to Miami.
I don't know. I do not understand that fit for, first of all, for Phoenix. I do not understand that fit for the Heat. I don't. Are they trying to
flip? So you don't like it for anybody?
I don't like it for either team. Because what is Beal? Tyler Hero probably right now is better than Bradley Beal.
Right now, like, he is. Today, he is.
As of right now, he is. Like, no, and I love Beal's game and what he became, you know, but this move makes no sense. I think Pat Riley's going to ask for Kevin Durant or Devin Booker, bro, and this deal is not going to go down.
Get down. It's no chance. But I'm curious, though. Let's just say, so the way the deal would have to be, one of the ways it would have to be constructed would be Bradley Beal to the Heat, and then Jimmy Butler and a minimum salary, Josh Richardson, to the Suns. That's one way the deal could work. Now, you said that you don't like the fit for the Suns.
No.
If Butler were to go there. Why is that?
Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Jimmy Butler. Now, Jimmy Butler brings that grit and that intensity. The Suns are missing that. The Suns are missing that little bit of that, you know, aggression. And if you get into a playoff series, do you have that mean streak? Or are you guys that are just going out there, scoring the ball, you know, trying to defend, can't really do that. Jimmy Butler's 35, 30. Is he 36?
35. He turns 36 ahead of his next contract.
I don't see. He naturally was a small forward. Kevin Durant naturally was a small forward. Devin Booker is a wing. The NBA wing is like, you got three wings again. I think the Suns need a big. I think the Suns need a low post presence that they could go to in big games. You know, like, it's just three of the same thing. I mean,
but why not? I don't think trading Bradley Beal for Jimmy Butler prevents you from dumping Yusuf Nurkic on some other team and getting a different big. I don't think a Butler deal prevents that, because I agree with you. That's their number one need. The number one need is a big. So I'm with you, but I don't think it precludes you from doing that.
They got three perimeter guys. Like, what their offense? Mike Budenholzer. He wants these guys shooting threes. Jimmy Butler, do you look at Jimmy Butler and say he's a three-point shooter?
No. Nope.
Jimmy Butler wants
to. But he is a downhill guy.
Yeah.
He gets to the basket. He can get to the rim. He can be a penetrator. And that is something I think they're missing.
Can he consistently do that? Can he consistently? He's 35, turning 36. Is he going to be doing that a year or two from now?
Maybe not. Maybe not. But I think for Phoenix, it is all about this year
right now
and the future. Like, yes, we might be effed, like we might be totally screwed, but I think for Phoenix it is all about maximizing this specific season and going for a championship, and then the future, like, their picks are gone. Like, they're gonna have some probably really bad years down the line.
Screwed. They're screwed.
Yeah, they will be at some point. So if I'm Phoenix, I do everything I can to get Jimmy Butler, and there's not a lot you can do. Like you traded everything already. I
mean, yeah, if you could get him, get him. See what you do this year. He brings a little bit of a different dimension. He's a different player than Booker and Durant. Booker and Durant are pure scorers. You know, they're going to bring that element to the game. Jimmy Butler's going to get to the basket, apply some rim pressure if his legs are fresh, if he's healthy. And, you know, he does bring a little bit of a presence come playoff time. That, for that reason, I understand it if it's for this 1 year or this next year, but these guys, Kevin Durant's getting older too. I don't know. I think they need to really make a splash and alter things. They need a big man. But like you said, they could do both. So let's see.
The tough part is going to be flipping Nurkic and finding the right big for him. He's on an $18 million deal this season. He has another year remaining on that. I mean, Nurkic could trade that salary, Okogie at $8 million. You know, I don't – Ryan Dunn, his shooting has fallen off after a fast start, but still an impressive defensive player. I'd still want to hold on to him. There's not a lot of bigs that, I mean, look, Nurkic, he is not very good. He's one of the bottom 10 probably starting centers in the NBA, but you can do a lot worse than Jusuf Nurkic. There's a lot of really bad bigs out there. So I think he's an 82 game guy, not a 16 game guy, to steal that line from Draymond Green. They need to find somebody who can do that 16 game stuff. It's just hard to find when you're so depleted of assets for Phoenix. So looking for upgrades wherever you can. Our third trade topic here, Akam, your guy, Zach LaVine, 21.7 points per game this season, shooting nearly 43% from three for the Chicago Bulls. Been playing really high-level basketball individually this year for Chicago. I think he's done a great job sharing the ball with their other ball handlers, White, Giddey, among others as well. LaVine has really performed well. Making $43 million this year, he's got $46 million the year after that, and then a $49 million player option, which I'd be shocked if he didn't pick that up when the time comes. Trading that salary is difficult, but I'm a bit surprised with why he's not talked about more often as a trade target. You mentioned him as a Lakers guy, someone who could fit there. Are there any other teams that you think stand out as a good fit for Zach LaVine, despite that big salary number?
I thought the Warriors should have made that move for him in the summer. He's an explosive scorer. Zach is, again, another guy that could go into any game, and he might have 36 points and be the best player on the floor, no matter who else is on the court, who else in the league is on the court. And it's hard to get that. It's hard to get a guy, like you said, what is it, 21 a night right now and 43% from three. You need a guy, next year stars, next year Trae Young, next year Steph, that can go do that. And you know, when you ask me fit, it's tough. Like, I think the Lakers are a good fit for him right now. They need that spark. I think the Dubs still, if they can, if they want. I mean, it don't look like it, but if they can, go get him. Put it this way. I would have Zach LaVine right now next to Jokic. No disrespect to my Canadian guy, Jamal Murray. Zach LaVine bringing what he does every single night next to Jokic. That Nuggets team looks different. It looks a little bit scarier. And if LaVine comes in motivated and says, I'm going to get this 21 up to 24, I'm going to take the last shot, I'm going to make these step backs when I need to in the crunch time, it's going to be a very, very lethal offense if they can maintain everything around that. I like the Nuggets fit for him. If they decide we want to move away from Murray, he don't look the same no more, I think LaVine right now could bring that fire to that squad.
All right, some quick hitters to close us out here. Jared McCain out indefinitely for the Philadelphia 76ers with a torn meniscus. And then you get Joel Embiid out at least a week with a sinus fracture. Dude, like, I mean,
it's bad.
I don't know what to say, man. Like, Philly's luck this year is just, it is gone. It is sad. Yeah. I mean, McCain was one of the bright spots for them, dude. When they got after their horrible start, they're still part of their horrible start. Yes. He's one of the bright spots. He looked like the rookie of the year at one point. He looked like a pure hooper.
Yep.
And here we are. What the hell, man?
He was hooping, man. And he was playing with, like, a joy and creativity, freedom. And he was complimenting Max. He was beautiful and getting buckets from all over the floor. Handle looks real nice. You know, he gets to the basket. He was in attack mode. So losing him, bro, they're in big trouble right now because they're just running out of gas completely. And they're parked in the middle of the desert. Tyrese Maxey's about to be left by himself. Paul George not trying to play back-to-backs. I don't know what's happening with Embiid. The Sixers might just have to blow it up at the deadline too. You never know.
Dude, like I think for Philly, maybe this is like the grand optimist right here. Maybe it ends up a blessing in disguise. Maybe like this horrific year, you get a lottery pick. Maybe that pick hits and you end up number one or number two or number three. And maybe you draft Cooper Flagg or Dylan Harper, or maybe you trade that pick and you go out and get a star. And then next year, everybody's healthy and you go out and go deeper than you ever have in the playoffs and maybe even win it all. That's the grand optimist.
Maybe.
The realist in me is like, you are screwed. And maybe you should think about blowing things up.
Yeah, I agree.
The problem with that is, like, you don't have all of your future picks. So a lot of complications there. I just think it sucks, man. I feel bad for Sixers fans because this was their on paper, their best offseason. They hit a home run getting Paul George, doing things the way they did, Embiid building on getting better every year. But then this happens. It just straight up sucks. Some good news right here. Greg Popovich released a statement through the San Antonio Spurs. He said this has been an unexpected 6 weeks for his family. He said thank you for the support to the Spurs community, Spurs Nation, to the fans, to the team, to the NBA community. He said no one is more excited to see me return to the bench than the talented individuals who have been helping leading my rehab. They've quickly learned that I'm less than coachable. Good to hear from Greg Popovich. What have your impressions been of the Spurs this year with their remade roster?
I mean, they're good. I haven't figured out what are they trying to do. Are they trying to make a play and push, or are they tanking? But with Wemby, you have a generational guy or a guy that can be, you know, looked at as generational 4, 5, 6 years from now. You know, Chris Paul is there. I do think, you know, with Castle, is this a squad that's trying to make a play and push? I can't tell.
They're trying to make a push. They want to make a push. That's what Pop's going to come back to. Whenever he comes back, he's going to come back to a team that's still trying to make that push. Right now, they are a game back from the Lakers for the 10 seed. Like it's tough competition this year, man. Like, that's
the West Spurs is tough. The West is tough, brutal, dude. Man. It's tough.
It's so tough.
Yeah.
Like Lakers are 14-12. The Clippers are also 14-12, and both of them have been really, really competitive for stretches this year, and yet they're the teams that would have to win twice to even get into the playoffs.
Yeah, exactly. But it'd be great for the NBA to have Wemby in a playing game, going up against those guys like a LeBron. You know, he's the future. He's the future of the league. He's the future face of the league. You already know what it is. Chris Paul, you'd love to see him go out playing competitive basketball on the way out. Let's see where the Spurs are a month from now, because I think they compete. You know, I think they show nights where they could be good defensively. Let's see how it is with Pop now. I think their season, these next 2 weeks are the most important of their season possibly.
Third topic from our little miscellaneous quick hitters group. This is a mailbag question from Jeff in Boston. He asks, Peyton Pritchard is the favorite for Sixth Man of the Year, but why is he not part of the Most Improved Player of the Year conversation? And it's a good question, because you have Peyton Pritchard this year averaging 16.5 points per game for the Celtics, up from 9.6 last year. His minutes, he's averaging 6 more minutes per game. He's getting more touches per game, even though it's not really reflected in the assist numbers. He's playing a much bigger role for that Celtics team. Do you think Pritchard does indeed belong in that Most Improved Player conversation when we're talking about guys like Tyler Hero, Jalen Johnson, Norm Powell, LaMelo Ball, even if you want to go to like kind of some of the higher end star type players? Do you think Pritchard belongs in that, Akam?
Yeah, traditionally what the Most Improved Player used to be was this, right? They'd go from, you know, they were a reserve, a young reserve that went out, you know, had a breakout season and became like this perennial, you know, starter or six man, and they're, but like we saw that award just changed, you know, like when Ja Morant won it, you know, now you're saying LaMelo Ball, you know, some of these guys like Norman Powell, you know, these guys are making big leaps statistically, you know, and they're doing things. They're the best player for their team on some nights, right? Pritchard is a hooper. Love his game. He was at our Pro-Am in Vancouver 2 years ago, put up a record, 61 points. Dude is a dog, man. And I think psychologically, because Boston won the championship, you saw Pritchard have moments where he's making half-court threes. You might not put him in that Most Improved Player thing, but I think this new role that he has where he's the sixth man of the year, it could be a great thing for his career. It could be a great thing for his identity and his role in the NBA for the next 5, 6 years. Because I think Pritchard is a guy that he could start right now. You know, I think when Chris Paul is gone from the Spurs, I think Pritchard is a great target for them to be their starting point guard one day. Ah. You know, I think Pritchard is having the same ascension as a Fred VanVleet was when he was in Toronto. Very similar ascension that we're witnessing right now with Pritchard. So, you know, we're not even looking at him and saying, hey, he's the Most Improved Player. You know, we're not surprised by anything he's doing. We're just happy to see him get an opportunity to showcase his true skill, his true ability, and the fact that he could also get after it defensively as a small guard. You know, and now the next step for Pritchard is just get to that playoff stage and do what you do, come off the bench and give us that 14, 15, 16 in a pivotal game three. And yo, he's going to become a household name playing with this Celtics squad.
I mean, I think I had not thought about the Spurs targeting Pritchard. Like, everybody talks about the big names, like Trae Young for the Spurs or De'Aaron Fox for the Spurs. But Peyton Pritchard running high pick and roll with Victor Wembanyama, or two-man game stuff with Stephon Castle, guard screens. Dude, like Pritchard, the player he's turning into, like he had against the Pistons the other night, 27 points and 10 assists. And he, I think, one turnover in the game. Mm-hmm. And he's had like eight assist games, but then he has games where he takes 10, 11, 12 threes. Like the reason why he's looking like the sixth man of the year is because he gives Boston what they need. If they need playmaking, he can do that. Usually they want the scoring spark. He always provides that. He provides gritty defense. He can even post up a little bit too. Post up P, as Celtics broadcast calls him. Pritchard gives the game what it needs. And the Fred VanVleet comp, the lane for him, is a smart one too. Because I feel like watching Pritchard, I find myself a lot of the time saying, if he were starting right now, like if he were on a team where they gave him this role every night, would he be averaging 24 points per game? 25 points per game. Would he be 18, averaging that?
18 and 7 for sure.
I mean, he's almost there already. He's at 16.5 points. I mean, I the assists are lower, but I think 20 plus is pretty conservative for Pritchard at the level he's performing right now.
Oh, 100%. But him being in this system, playing for this squad, they're going to be on the national stage for the next 3-4 years. His contract is what, 3 more years? I like it. I like this for Pritchard. And then break out and do your own solo act after that run is over.
Yeah, yep. He's got 3 more years remaining after this one. Boy, what a bargain contract. Yeah. Just throwing out the numbers real quick.
Oh, man.
He's making $6.7 million this year.
Yeah.
7.2 next year. 7.8 the year after that. And then 8.3. That is peanuts.
He's underpaid, that's nothing, man.
Oh, my God. There's rookies making more than him.
He's outperforming. Oh, my God. It's crazy. It's crazy.
What the hell?
Man.
Oh, my God. If you're ranking the best bargain contracts in the league, I like
right there.
outside of like the non-rookie scale contracts,
that's the one.
That might be number one.
It is.
My
God. It is, man.
Oh, man. Akam, ball don't stop. Where can we find your stuff, man?
Instagram. I'm on X, you know, formerly known as Twitter. I'm out there. You know, you'll see me on the feed if you love basketball. I'll make sure I'm on your feed somehow, some way.
either making you mad or educating you, one or the other, right?
That's it. That's what I do.
The ball don't stop. Appreciate you joining me on today's show,
brother.
Man.
Appreciate you.
Thank you to Ball Don't Stop and Andrew Schleck for joining me on today's episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Appreciate you giving us a listen. Thanks again to Andrew and Akam for joining me on today's episode. Please give us a 5-star rating and a like anywhere you're listening to this podcast. It really does help us out. Thanks to Joe and Stone and Brett all for producing today's episode. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back again later in the week with Tom Haverstraw. Looking forward to that. Enjoy the NBA Cup. Enjoy all the games. Enjoy your week. Have a good one.